instead of Dora. I only mean that you should think of me that way. When you're going to be angry with me, say to yourself, it's only my child wife. When I'm very disappointing, say, I knew a long time ago that she would make but a child wife. When you miss what I should like to be, and I think can never be, say, still my foolish child wife loves me, for indeed I do. I had not been serious with her, having no idea until now that she was serious herself. But her affectionate nature was so happy in what I now said to her with my whole heart, that her face became a laughing one before her glittering eyes were dry. She was soon my child wife indeed, sitting down on the floor outside the Chinese house, ringing all the little bells, one after another, to punish Jip for his recent bad behaviour, while Jip lay blinking in the doorway with his head out, even too lazy to be teased. This appeal of Dora's made a strong impression on me. I look back on the time I write of. I invoke the innocent figure that I dearly loved to come out from the mists and shadows of the past and turn its gentle head towards me once again. And I can still declare that this one little speech was constantly in my memory. I may not have used it to the best account. I was young and inexperienced. But I never turned a deaf ear to its artless pleading. Dora told me shortly afterwards that she was going to be a wonderful housekeeper. Accordingly, she polished the tablets, pointed the pencil, bought an immense account book, carefully stitched up with a needle and thread all the leaves of the cookery book which Jip had torn, and made quite a desperate little attempt to be good, as she called it. But the figures had the old obstinate propensity. They would not add up. When she'd entered two or three laborious items in the account book, Jip would walk over the page, wagging his tail, and smear them all out. Her own little right-hand middle finger got steeped to the very bone in ink, and I think that was the only decided result attained. Sometimes of an evening, when I was at home and at work, for I wrote a good deal now, and was beginning in a small way to be known as a writer, I would lay down my pen and watch my child wife trying to be good. First of all, she would bring out the immense account book and lay it down upon the table with a deep sigh. Then she would open it at the place where Jip had made it illegible last night, and call Jip up to look at his misdeeds. This would occasion a diversion in Jip's favour, and some inking of his nose, perhaps, as a penalty. Then she would tell Jip to lie down on the table instantly, like a lion, which was one of his tricks, though I can't say the likeness was striking, and if he were in an obedient humour he would obey. Then she would take up a pen and begin to write and find a hair in it. Then she would take up another pen and begin to write and find that it spluttered. Then she would take up another pen and begin to write and say in a low voice, "Oh, it's a talking pen and will disturb Dodie." And then she would give it up as a bad job and put the account book away after pretending to crush the lion with it. Or, if she were in a very sedate and serious state of mind, she would sit down with the tablets and a little basket of bills and other documents, which looked more like curl papers than anything else, and endeavour to get some result out of them. After frowningly comparing one with another and making entries on the tablets and blotting them out and counting all the fingers of her left hand over and over again, backwards and forwards, she would be so vexed and discouraged and would look so unhappy that it gave me pain to see her bright face clouded, and for me. And I would go softly to her and say, "What's the matter, Dora?" Dora would look up hopelessly and reply, "They won't come right. They make my head ache so, and they won't do anything I want." Then I would say, "Now let us try together. Let me show you, Dora." Then I would commence a practical demonstration, to which Dora would pay profound attention, perhaps for 5 minutes, when she would begin to be dreadfully tired, and would lighten the subject by curling my hair or trying the effect of my face with my shirt collar turned down. If I tacitly checked this playfulness and persisted, she would look so scared and disconsolate as she became more and more bewildered that the remembrance of her natural gaiety when I first strayed into her path, and of her being my child wife, would come reproachfully upon me, and I would lay the pencil down and call for the guitar. I had a great deal of work to do, and had many anxieties, but the same considerations made me keep them to myself. I'm far from sure now that it was right to do this, but I did it for my child wife's sake. I search my breast, and I commit its secrets, if I know them, without any reservation, to this paper. The old unhappy loss or want of something had, I'm conscious, some place in my heart, but not to the embitterment of my life. When I walked alone in the fine weather and thought of the summer days when all the air had been filled with my boyish enchantment, I did miss something of the realization of my dreams, but I thought it was a softened glory of the past, which nothing could have thrown upon the present time. I did feel sometimes, for a little while, that I could have wished my wife had been my counsellor, had had more character and purpose to sustain me and improve me by, had been endowed with power to fill up the void which somewhere seemed to be about me. But I felt as if this were an unearthly consummation of my happiness that never had been meant to be and never could have been. I was a boyish husband as to years. I'd known the softening influence of no other sorrows or experiences than those recorded in these leaves. If I did any wrong, as I may have done much, I did it in mistaken love and in my want of wisdom. I write the exact truth. It would avail me nothing to extenuate it now. Thus it was that I took upon myself the toils and cares of our life and had no partner in them. We lived much as before in reference to our scrambling household arrangements, but I'd got used to those, and Dora, I was pleased to see, was seldom vexed now. She was bright and cheerful in the old childish way, loved me dearly, and was happy with her old trifles. When the debates were heavy, I mean as to length, not quality, for in the last respect they were not often otherwise, and I went home late, Dora would never rest when she heard my footsteps, but would always come downstairs to meet me. When my evenings were unoccupied by the pursuit for which I'd qualified myself with so much pains, and I was engaged in writing at home, she would sit quietly near me, however late the hour, and be so mute that I would often think she'd dropped asleep. But generally, when I raised my head, I saw her blue eyes looking at me with the quiet attention of which I have already spoken. "Oh, what a weary boy," said Dora one night, when I met her eyes as I was shutting up my desk. "What a weary girl," said I, "that's more to the purpose. You must go to bed another time, my love. It's far too late for you." "No, don't send me to bed," pleaded Dora, coming to my side. "Pray don't do that." "Dora!" To my amazement, she was sobbing on my neck. "Not well, my dear, not happy." "Yes, quite well and very happy," said Dora, "but say you let me stop and see you write." "Why, what a sight for such bright eyes at midnight," I replied. "Are they bright, though?" returned Dora, laughing. "I'm so glad they're bright." "Little vanity," said I. But it wasn't vanity. It was only harmless delight in my admiration. I knew that very well before she told me so. "If you think them pretty, say I may always stop and see you write," said Dora. "Do you think them pretty?" "Very pretty." "Then let me always stop and see you write." "I'm afraid that won't improve their brightness, Dora." "Yes, it will. Because, you clever boy, you'll not forget me then while you're full of silent fancies. Will you mind it if I say something very, very silly?" "More than usual?" inquired Dora, peeping over my shoulder into my face. "What wonderful thing is that?" said I. "Please let me hold the pens," said Dora. "I want to have something to do with all those many hours when you're so industrious. May I hold the pens?" The remembrance of her pretty joy when I said yes brings tears into my eyes. The next time I sat down to write, and regularly afterwards, she sat in her old place, with a spare bundle of pens at her side. Her triumph in this connection with my work, and her delight when I wanted a new pen, which I very often feigned to do, suggested to me a new way of pleasing my child wife. I occasionally made a pretense of wanting a page or two of manuscript copied. Then Dora was in her glory. The preparation she made for this great work, the apron she put on, the bib she borrowed from the kitchen to keep off the ink, the time she took, the innumerable stoppages she made to have a laugh with Jip, as if he understood it all, her conviction that her work was incomplete unless she signed her name at the end, and the way in which she would bring it to me like a school copy, and then, when I praised it, clasp me round the neck, are touching recollections to me, simple as they might appear to other men. She took possession of the keys soon after this, and went jingling about the house with a whole bunch in a little basket tied to her slender waist. I seldom found that the places to which they belonged were locked, or that they were of any use except as a plaything for Jip, but Dora was pleased, and that pleased me. She was quite satisfied that a good deal was effected by this make-belief of housekeeping, and was as merry as if we'd been keeping a baby house for a joke. So we went on. Dora was hardly less affectionate to my aunt than to me, and often told her of the time when she was afraid she was a cross old thing. I never saw my aunt unbend more systematically to anyone. She courted Jip, though Jip never responded, listened day after day to the guitar, though I'm afraid she had no taste for music, never attacked the incapables, though the temptation must have been severe, went wonderful distances on foot to purchase as surprises any trifles that she found out Dora wanted, and never came in by the garden and missed her from the room, but she would call out at the foot of the stairs, in a voice that sounded cheerfully all over the house, "Where's Little Blossom?" Chapter 45. Mr. Dick Fulfills My Aunt's Prediction. It was some time now since I had left the doctor. Living in his neighbourhood, I saw him frequently, and we all went to his house on two or three occasions to dinner or tea. The old soldier was in permanent quarters under the doctor's roof. She was exactly the same as ever, and the same immortal butterflies hovered over her cap. Like some other mothers whom I've known in the course of my life, Mrs. Markleham was far more fond of pleasure than her daughter was. She required a great deal of amusement, and like a deep old soldier pretended, in consulting her own inclinations, to be devoting herself to her child. The doctor's desire that Annie should be entertained was therefore particularly acceptable to this excellent parent, who expressed unqualified approval of his discretion. I have no doubt, indeed, that she probed the doctor's wound without knowing it, meaning nothing but a certain matured frivolity and selfishness, not always inseparable from full-blown years. I think she confirmed in him his fear that he was a constraint upon his young wife, and that there was no congeniality of feeling between them, by so strongly commending his design of lightening the load of her life. "My dear soul," she said to him one day when I was present, "you know there's no doubt it would be a little pokey for Annie to be always shut up here." The doctor nodded his benevolent head. "When she comes to a mother's age," said Mrs. Markleham, with a flourish of her fan, "then it'll be another thing. You might put me into a jail with genteel society and a rubber, and I should never care to come out. But I'm not Annie, you know, and Annie's not her mother." "Surely, surely," said the doctor. "You're the best of creatures." "No, I beg your pardon," for the doctor made a gesture of depreciation. "I must say before your face, as I always say behind your back, you are the best of creatures. But of course you don't now, do you, enter into the same pursuits and fancies as Annie?" "No," said the doctor, in a sorrowful tone. "No, of course not. retorted the old soldier. "Take your dictionary, for example. What a useful work a dictionary is. What a necessary work. The meaning of words. Without Dr. Johnson or somebody of that sort, we might have been at this present moment calling an Italian iron a bedstead. But we can't expect a dictionary, especially when it's making, to interest Annie, can we?" The doctor shook his head. "And that's why I so much approve," said Mrs. Markleham, tapping him on the shoulder with her shut-up fan, "of your thoughtfulness. It shows that you don't expect, as many elderly people do expect, old heads on young shoulders. You've studied Annie's character, and you understand it. That's what I find so charming." Even the calm and patient face of Dr. Strong expressed some little sense of pain, I thought, under the infliction of these compliments. "Therefore, my dear doctor," said the soldier, giving him several affectionate taps, "you may command me at all times and seasons. Now, do understand that I am entirely at your service. I am ready to go with Annie to operas, concerts, exhibitions, all kinds of places, and you shall never find that I'm tired. Duty, my dear doctor, before every consideration in the universe." She was as good as her word. She was one of those people who can bear a great deal of pleasure, and she never flinched in her perseverance in the cause. She seldom got hold of the newspaper, which she settled herself down in the softest chair in the house to read through an eyeglass every day for 2 hours, but she found out something that she was certain Annie would like to see. It was in vain for Annie to protest that she was weary of such things. Her mother's remonstrance always was, "Now, my dear Annie, I'm sure you know better, and I must tell you, my love, that you're not making a proper return for the kindness of Dr. Strong." This was usually said in the doctor's presence, and appeared to me to constitute Annie's principal inducement for withdrawing her objections when she made any. But, in general, she resigned herself to her mother and went where the old soldier would. It rarely happened now that Mr. Malden accompanied them. Sometimes my aunt and Dora were invited to do so and accepted the invitation. Sometimes Dora only was asked. The time had been when I should have been uneasy in her going. But reflection on what had passed that former night in the doctor's study had made a change in my mistrust. I believed that the doctor was right, and I had no worse suspicions. My aunt rubbed her nose sometimes when she happened to be alone with me and said she couldn't make it out. She wished they were happier. She didn't think our military friend, as she always called the old soldier, mended the matter at all. My aunt further expressed her opinion that if our military friend would cut off those butterflies and give them to the chimney sweepers for May Day, it would look like the beginning of something sensible on her part. But her abiding reliance was on Mr. Dick. That man had evidently an idea in his head, she said, and if he could only once penny it up into a corner, which was his great difficulty, he would distinguish himself in some extraordinary manner. Unconscious of this prediction, Mr. Dick continued to occupy precisely the same ground in reference to the doctor and to Mrs. Strong. He seemed neither to advance nor to recede. He appeared to have settled into his original foundation like a building, and I must confess that my faith in his ever-moving was not much greater than if he had been a building. But one night, when I'd been married some months, Mr. Dick put his head into the parlour where I was writing alone, Dora having gone out with my aunt to take tea with the two little birds, and said, with a significant cough, "You couldn't speak to me without inconveniencing yourself, Trotwood, I'm afraid." "Certainly, Mr. Dick," said I. "Come in." "Trotwood," said Mr. Dick, laying his finger on the side of his nose after he'd shaken hands with me, "before I sit down, I wish to make an observation. You know your aunt?" "A little," I replied. "She is the most wonderful woman in the world, sir." After the delivery of this communication, which he shot out of himself as if he were loaded with it, Mr. Dick sat down with greater gravity than usual and looked at me. "Now, boy," said Mr. Dick, "I am going to put a question to you." "As many as you please," said I. "What do you consider me, sir?" asked Mr. Dick, folding his arms. "A dear old friend," said I.
"Thank you, Trotwood,"
returned Mr. Dick, laughing and reaching across in high glee to shake hands with me. "But I mean, boy," resuming his gravity, "what do you consider me in this respect?" touching his forehead. I was puzzled how to answer, but he helped me with a word. "Weak," said Mr. Dick. "Well," I replied dubiously, "rather so."
"Exactly," cried Mr. Dick, who seemed enchanted by my reply. "That is Trotwood when they took some of the trouble out of you-know-whose head, and put it you-know-where. There was a..." Mr. Dick made his two hands revolve very fast about each other a great number of times, and then brought them into collision and rolled them over and over one another to express confusion. "There was that sort of thing done to me somehow, eh?" I nodded at him, and he nodded back again. "In short, boy," said Mr. Dick, dropping his voice to a whisper, "I am simple." I would have qualified that conclusion, but he stopped me. "Yes, I am. She pretends I'm not. She won't hear of it, but I am. I know I am. If she hadn't stood my friend, sir, I should have been shut up to lead a dismal life these many years. But I'll provide for her. I never spend the copying money. I put it in a box. I've made a will. I'll leave it all to her. She shall be rich, noble." Mr. Dick took out his pocket handkerchief and wiped his eyes. He then folded it up with great care, pressed it smooth between his two hands, put it in his pocket, and seemed to put my aunt away with it. "Now, you're a scholar, Trotwood," said Mr. Dick. "You are a fine scholar. You know what a learned man, what a great man the doctor is. You know what honour he has always done me, not proud in his wisdom, humble, humble, condescending even to poor Dick, who is simple and knows nothing. I have sent his name up on a scrap of paper to the kite, along the string, when it's been in the sky among the larks. The kite has been glad to receive it, sir, and the sky has been brighter with it." I delighted him by saying most heartily that the doctor was deserving of our best respect and highest esteem. "And his beautiful wife is a star," said Mr. Dick, "a shining star. I've seen her shine, sir. But," bringing his chair nearer and laying one hand upon my knee, "clouds, sir. Clouds." I answered the solicitude which his face expressed by conveying the same expression into my own and shaking my head. "What clouds?" said Mr. Dick. He looked so wistfully into my face and was so anxious to understand that I took great pains to answer him slowly and distinctly, as I might have entered on an explanation to a child. "There is some unfortunate division between them," I replied. "Some unhappy cause of separation. A secret. It may be inseparable from the discrepancy in their years. It may have grown up out of almost nothing." Mr. Dick, who told off every sentence with a thoughtful nod, paused when I'd done, and sat considering, with his eyes upon my face and his hand upon my knee. "Doctor, not angry with her, Trotwood?" he said after some time. "No, devoted to her." "Then I've got it, boy," said Mr. Dick. The sudden exultation with which he slapped me on the knee and leant back in his chair with his eyebrows lifted up as high as he could possibly lift them made me think him farther out of his wits than ever. He became as suddenly grave again, and leaning forward as before, said, first respectfully taking out his pocket handkerchief as if it really did represent my aunt, "Most wonderful woman in the world, Trotwood. Why has she done nothing to set things right?"
"Too delicate and difficult a subject for such interference," I replied.
"Fine scholar," said Mr. Dick, touching me with his finger. "Why has he done nothing?"
"For the same reason," I returned.
"Then I've got it, boy," said Mr. Dick, and he stood up before me more exultingly than before, nodding his head and striking himself repeatedly upon the breast, until one might have supposed that he'd nearly nodded and struck all the breath out of his body. "A poor fellow with a craze, sir," said Mr. Dick. "A simpleton, a weak-minded person. Present company, you know," striking himself again, "may do what wonderful people may not do. I'll bring them together, boy. I'll try. They'll not blame me. They'll not object to me. They'll not mind what I do if it's wrong. I'm only Mr. Dick. And who minds Dick? Dick's nobody. Fool!"
He blew a slight contemptuous breath, as if he blew himself away. It was fortunate he had proceeded so far with his mystery, for we heard the coach stop at the little garden gate which brought my aunt and Dora home.
"Not a word, boy," he pursued in a whisper. "Leave all the blame with Dick. Simple Dick, mad Dick. I've been thinking, sir, for some time that I was getting it, and now I've got it. After what you said to me, I'm sure I've got it. All right."
Not another word did Mr. Dick utter on the subject. But he made a very telegraph of himself for the next half hour, to the great disturbance of my aunt's mind, to enjoin inviolable secrecy on me. To my surprise, I heard no more about it for some 2 or 3 weeks, though I was sufficiently interested in the result of his endeavours, descrying a strange gleam of good sense, I say nothing of good feeling, for that he always exhibited, in the conclusion to which he'd come. At last I began to believe that, in the flighty and unsettled state of his mind, he'd either forgotten his intention or abandoned it. One fair evening, when Dora was not inclined to go out, my aunt and I strolled up to the doctor's cottage. It was autumn, when there were no debates to vex the evening air, and I remember how the leaves smelt like our garden at Blunderston as we trod them underfoot, and how the old, unhappy feeling seemed to go by on the sighing wind. It was twilight when we reached the cottage. Mrs. Strong was just coming out of the garden, where Mr. Dick yet lingered, busy with his knife, helping the gardener to point some stakes. The doctor was engaged with someone in his study, but the visitor would be gone directly, Mrs. Strong said, and begged us to remain and see him. We went into the drawing-room with her, and sat down by the darkening window. There was never any ceremony about the visits of such old friends and neighbours as we were. We'd not sat here many minutes when Mrs. Markleham, who usually contrived to be in a fuss about something, came bustling in, with her newspaper in her hand, and said, out of breath, "My goodness gracious, Annie, why didn't you tell me there was someone in the study?" "My dear Mama," she quietly returned, "how could I know that you desired the information?"
"Desire the information?" said Mrs. Markleham, sinking on the sofa. "I never had such a turn in all my life."
"Have you been to the study then, Mama?" asked Annie.
"Been to the study, my dear?" she returned emphatically. "Indeed I have. I came upon the amiable creature, if you'll imagine my feelings, Miss Trotwood and David, in the act of making his will."
Her daughter looked round from the window quickly.
"In the act, my dear Annie," repeated Mrs. Markleham, spreading the newspaper on her lap like a tablecloth and then putting her hands upon it, "of making his last will and testament. The foresight and affection of the dear. I must tell you how it was. I really must, in justice to the darling, for he is nothing less, tell you how it was. Perhaps you know, Miss Trotwood, that there is never a candle lighted in this house until one's eyes are literally falling out of one's head with being stretched to read the paper, and that there is not a chair in this house in which a paper can be what I call read, except one in the study. This took me to the study, where I saw a light. I opened the door. in company with the dear doctor were two professional people evidently connected with the law, and they were all three standing at the table, the darling doctor pen in hand. "This simply expresses, then," said the doctor, "Annie, my love, attend to the very words. This simply expresses, then, gentlemen, the confidence I have in Mrs. Strong, and gives her all unconditionally." One of the professional people replied, "And gives her all unconditionally." Upon that, with the natural feelings of a mother, I said, "Good God, I beg your pardon," fell over the doorstep, and came away through the little back passage where the pantry is. Mrs. Strong opened the window, and went out into the veranda, where she stood leaning against a pillar.
"But now, isn't it, Miss Trotwood, isn't it, David, invigorating," said Mrs. Markleham, mechanically following her with her eyes, "to find a man at Dr. Strong's time of life with the strength of mind to do this kind of thing? It only shows how right I was. I said to Annie, when Dr. Strong paid a very flattering visit to myself and made her the subject of a declaration and an offer, I said, 'My dear, there is no doubt whatever, in my opinion, with reference to a suitable provision for you, that Dr. Strong will do more than he binds himself to do.'" Here the bell rang, and we heard the sound of the visitors' feet as they went out. "It's all over, no doubt," said the old soldier, after listening. "The dear creature has signed, sealed, and delivered, and his mind's at rest. Well, it may be. What a mind! Annie, my love, I am going to the study with my paper, for I'm a poor creature without news. Miss Trotwood, David, pray come and see the doctor." I was conscious of Mr. Dick standing in the shadow of the room, shutting up his knife when we accompanied her to the study, and of my aunt's rubbing her nose violently, by the way, as a mild vent for her intolerance of our military friend. But who got first into the study, or how Mrs. Markleham settled herself at a moment in her easy chair, or how my aunt and I came to be left together near the door, unless her eyes were quicker than mine and she held me back, I've forgotten, if I ever knew. But this I know, that we saw the doctor before us, sitting at his table, among the folio volumes in which he delighted, resting his head calmly on his hand. That, in the same moment, we saw Mrs. Strong glide in, pale and trembling. That Mr. Dick supported her on his arm. That he laid his other hand upon the doctor's arm, causing him to look up with an abstracted air. That as the doctor moved his head, his wife dropped down on one knee at his feet, and with her hands imploringly lifted, fixed upon her face the memorable look I had never forgotten. That at this sight, Mrs. Markleham dropped the newspaper, and stared more like a figurehead intended for a ship to be called the Astonishment than anything else I can think of. The gentleness of the doctor's manner and surprise, the dignity that mingled with the supplicating attitude of his wife, the amiable concern of Mr. Dick, and the earnestness with which my aunt said to herself, "That man mad!" triumphantly expressive of the misery from which she'd saved him, I see and hear rather than remember as I write about it. "Doctor," said Mr. Dick, "what is it that's amiss? Look here." "Annie," cried the doctor, "not at my feet, my dear." "Yes," she said. "I beg and pray that no one will leave the room. Oh, my husband and father, break this long silence. Let us both know what it is that has come between us." Mrs. Markleham, by this time recovering the power of speech, and seeming to swell with family pride and motherly indignation, here exclaimed, "Annie, get up immediately, and don't disgrace everybody belonging to you by humbling yourself like that, unless you wish to see me go out of my mind on the spot." "Mamma," returned Annie, "waste no words on me, for my appeal is to my husband, and even you are nothing here." "Nothing?" exclaimed Mrs. Markleham. "Me, nothing? The child has taken leave of her senses. Please do get me a glass of water." I was too attentive to the doctor and his wife to give any heed to this request, and it made no impression on anybody else, so Mrs. Markleham panted, stared, and fanned herself. "Annie," said the doctor, tenderly taking her in his hands, "my dear,
If any unavoidable change has come in the sequence of time upon our married life, you are not to blame. The fault is mine, and only mine. There is no change in my affection, admiration, and respect. I wish to make you happy. I truly love and honour you. Rise, Annie, pray. But she did not rise. After looking at him for a little while, she sank down closer to him, laid her arm across his knee, and dropping her head upon it, said, "If I have any friend here who can speak one word for me, or for my husband in this matter, if I have any friend here who can give a voice to any suspicion that my heart has sometimes whispered to me, if I have any friend here who honours my husband, or has ever cared for me, and has anything within his knowledge, no matter what it is, that may help to mediate between us, I implore that friend to speak." There was a profound silence. After a few moments of painful hesitation, I broke the silence. "Mrs. Strong," I said, "there is something within my knowledge which I have been earnestly entreated by Dr. Strong to conceal, and have concealed until tonight. But I believe the time has come when it would be mistaken faith and delicacy to conceal it any longer, and when your appeal absolves me from his injunction." She turned her face towards me for a moment, and I knew that I was right. I could not have resisted its entreaty if the assurance that it gave me had been less convincing. "Our future peace," she said, "may be in your hands. I trust it confidently to your not suppressing anything. I know beforehand that nothing you or anyone can tell me will show my husband's noble heart in any other light than one. Howsoever it may seem to you to touch me, disregard that. I will speak for myself before him and before God afterwards." Thus earnestly besought, I made no reference to the doctor for his permission, but without any other compromise of the truth than a little softening of the coarseness of Uriah Heep, related plainly what had passed in that same room that night. The staring of Mrs. Markleham during the whole narration, and the shrill, sharp interjections with which she occasionally interrupted it, defy description. When I'd finished, Annie remained for some few moments silent, with her head bent down, as I've described. Then she took the doctor's hand — he was sitting in the same attitude as when we'd entered the room — and pressed it to her breast and kissed it. Mr. Dick softly raised her, and she stood, when she began to speak, leaning on him and looking down upon her husband, from whom she never turned her eyes. "All that has ever been in my mind since I was married," she said in a low, submissive, tender voice, "I will lay bare before you. I could not live and have one reservation, knowing what I know now." "Nay, Annie," said the doctor mildly, "I have never doubted you, my child. There's no need, indeed, there's no need, my dear." "There is great need," she answered in the same way, "that I should open my whole heart before the soul of generosity and truth, whom, year by year and day by day, I have loved and venerated more and more, as heaven knows."
"Really," interrupted Mrs. Markleham, "if I have any discretion at all—" "Which you haven't, you marplot," observed my aunt in an indignant whisper. "I must be permitted to observe that it cannot be requisite to enter into these details."
"No one but my husband can judge of that, mamma," said Annie, without removing her eyes from his face, "and he will hear me. If I say anything to give you pain, mamma, forgive me. I have borne pain first, often and long, myself."
"Upon my word," gasped Mrs. Markleham.
"When I was very young," said Annie, "quite a little child, my first associations with knowledge of any kind were inseparable from a patient friend and teacher, the friend of my dead father, who was always dear to me. I can remember nothing that I know without remembering him.
He stored my mind with its first treasures and stamped his character upon them all. They never could have been, I think, as good as they have been to me if I had taken them from any other hands.
Make some of them nothing! Exclaimed Mrs. Markleham.
Not so, Mamma, said Annie, but I make him what he was. I must do that. As I grew up, he occupied the same place still. I was proud of his interest, deeply, fondly, gratefully attached to him. I looked up to him, I can hardly describe how, as a father, as a guide, as one whose praise was different from all other praise, as one in whom I could have trusted and confided if I had doubted all the world. You know, Mamma, how young and inexperienced I was when you presented him before me of a sudden as a lover.
I've mentioned the fact 50 times at least to everybody here, said Mrs. Markleham.
Then hold your tongue for the Lord's sake and don't mention it any more, muttered my aunt.
It was so great a change, so great a loss, I felt it at first, said Annie, still preserving the same look and tone, that I was agitated and distressed. I was but a girl, and when so great a change came in the character in which I had so long looked up to him, I think I was sorry. But nothing could have made him what he used to be again, and I was proud that he should think me so worthy, and we were married.
At St. Olphage, Canterbury, observed Mrs. Markleham. Confound the woman, said my aunt, she won't be quiet.
I never thought, proceeded Annie, with a heightened colour, of any worldly gain that my husband would bring to me. My young heart had no room in its homage for any such poor reference. Mamma, forgive me when I say that it was you who first presented to my mind the thought that anyone could wrong me and wrong him by such a cruel suspicion.
Me? Cried Mrs. Markleham. Ah, you to be sure, observed my aunt, and you can't fan it away, my military friend.
It was the first unhappiness of my new life, said Annie. It was the first occasion of every unhappy moment I have known. Those moments have been more of late than I can count, but not, my generous husband, not for the reason you suppose. For in my heart there is not a thought, a recollection, or a hope that any power could separate from you. She raised her eyes and clasped her hands, and looked as beautiful and true, I thought, as any spirit. The doctor looked on her henceforth as steadfastly as she on him. "Mamma is blameless," she went on, "of having ever urged you for herself, and she is blameless in intention every way, I'm sure. But when I saw how many importunate claims that were no claims were pressed upon you in my name, how you were traded on in my name, how generous you were, and how Mr. Wickfield, who had your welfare very much at heart, resented it, the first sense of my exposure to the mean suspicion that my tenderness was bought and sold to you of all men on earth, fell upon me like unmerited disgrace in which I forced you to participate. I cannot tell you what it was, Mamma cannot imagine what it was, to have this dread and trouble always on my mind, yet know in my own soul that on my marriage day I crowned the love and honour of my life.
A specimen of the thanks one gets, cried Mrs. Markleham in tears, for taking care of one's family. I wish I was a Turk.
I wish you were, with all my heart, and in your native country, said my aunt.
This ends side one of cassette 21. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
It was at that time that Mamma was most solicitous about my cousin Maldon. I liked him, she spoke softly but openly and without any hesitation, very much. We had been little lovers once. If circumstances had not happened otherwise, I might have come to persuade myself that I really loved him and might have married him and been most wretched. There can be no disparity in marriage like unsuitability of mind and purpose. I pondered on those words, even while I was studiously attending to what followed, as if they had some particular interest or some strange application that I could not divine. There can be no disparity in marriage, like unsuitability of mind and purpose. No disparity in marriage like unsuitability of mind and purpose. There is nothing, said Annie, that we have in common. I've long found that there is nothing. If I were thankful to my husband for no more instead of for so much, I should be thankful to him for having saved me from the first mistaken impulse of my undisciplined heart. She stood quite still before the doctor and spoke with an earnestness that thrilled me, yet her voice was just as quiet as before. When he was waiting to be the object of your munificence, so freely bestowed for my sake, and when I was unhappy in the mercenary shape I was made to wear, I thought it would have become him better to have worked his own way on. I thought that if I had been he, I would have tried to do it at the cost of almost any hardship. But I thought no worse of him until the night of his departure for India. That night I knew he had a false and thankless heart. I saw a double meaning then in Mr. Wickfield's scrutiny of me. I perceived for the first time the dark suspicion that shadowed my life.
Suspicion, Annie? Said the doctor. No, no, no.
In your mind there was none, I know, my husband, she returned. And when I came to you that night to lay down all my load of shame and grief and knew that I had to tell that underneath your roof one of my own kindred to whom you had been a benefactor for the love of me had spoken to me words that should have found no utterance, even if I'd been the weak and mercenary wretch he thought me, my mind revolted from the taint the very tale conveyed. It died upon my lips, and from that hour till now has never passed them. Mrs. Markleham, with a short groan, leant back in her easy chair and retired behind her fan, as if she were never coming out any more. I have never, but in your presence, interchanged a word with him from that time, then only when it's been necessary for the avoidance of this explanation. Years have passed since he knew from me what his situation here was. The kindnesses you have secretly done for his advancement and then disclosed to me for my surprise and pleasure have been, you will believe, but aggravations of the unhappiness and burden of my secret. She sunk down gently at the doctor's feet, though he did his utmost to prevent her, and said, looking up tearfully into his face, "Do not speak to me yet. Let me say a little more. Right or wrong, if this were to be done again, I think I should do just the same. You never can know what it was to be devoted to you with those old associations, to find that anyone could be so hard as to suppose that the truth of my heart was bartered away, and to be surrounded by appearances confirming that belief. I was very young and had no adviser. Between Mama and me, in all relating to you, there was a wide division. If I shrunk into myself, hiding the disrespect I had undergone, it was because I honoured you so much, and so much wished that you should honour me.
Annie, my pure heart, said the doctor, my dear girl.
A little more. A very few words more. I used to think there were so many whom you might have married, who would not have brought such charge and trouble on you, and it would have made your home a worthier home. I used to be afraid that I had better have remained your pupil and almost your child. I used to fear that I was so unsuited to your learning and wisdom. If all this made me shrink within myself, as indeed it did, when I had that to tell, it was still because I honoured you so much and hoped that you might one day honour me.
That day has shone this long time, Annie, said the doctor, and can have but one long night, my dear.
Another word. I afterwards meant, steadfastly meant, and purposed to myself, to bear the whole weight of knowing the unworthiness of one to whom you had been so good. And now a last word, dearest and best of friends. The cause of the late change in you, which I have seen with so much pain and sorrow, and have sometimes referred to my old apprehension, at other times to lingering suppositions nearer to the truth, has been made clear tonight. And by an accident I have also come to know tonight the full measure of your noble trust in me, even under that mistake. I do not hope that any love and duty I may render in return will ever make me worthy of your priceless confidence. But with all this knowledge fresh upon me, I can lift my eyes to this dear face, revered as a father's, loved as a husband's, sacred to me in my childhood as a friend's, and solemnly declare that in my lightest thought I have never wronged you, never wavered in the love and the fidelity I owe you. She had her arms around the doctor's neck, and he bent his head down over her, mingling his grey hair with her dark brown tresses. Oh, hold me to your heart, my husband. Never cast me out. Do not think or speak of disparity between us, for there is none except in all my many imperfections. Every succeeding year I've known this better, as I have esteemed you more and more. Oh, take me to your heart, my husband, for my love was founded on a rock, and it endures. In the silence that ensued, my aunt walked gravely up to Mr. Dick, without at all hurrying herself, and gave him a hug and a sounding kiss. And it was very fortunate, with a view to his credit, that she did so. For I am confident that I detected him at that moment in the act of making preparations to stand on one leg, as an appropriate expression of delight. "You are a very remarkable man, Dick," said my aunt, with an air of unqualified approbation, "and never pretend to be anything else, for I know better." With that, my aunt pulled him by the sleeve and nodded to me, and we three stole quietly out of the room and came away. "That's a settler for our military friend, at any rate," said my aunt on the way home. "I should sleep the better for that if there was nothing else to be glad of." "She was quite overcome, I'm afraid," said Mr. Dick with great commiseration. "What? Did you ever see a crocodile overcome?" inquired my aunt. "I don't think I ever saw a crocodile," returned Mr. Dick mildly. "There never would have been anything the matter if it hadn't been for that old animal," said my aunt, with strong emphasis. "It's very much to be wished that some mothers would leave their daughters alone after marriage and not be so violently affectionate. They seem to think the only return that can be made them for bringing an unfortunate young woman into the world, God bless my soul, as if she asked to be brought or wanted to come, is full liberty to worry her out of it again. What are you thinking of, Trot?" I was thinking of all that had been said. My mind was still running on some of the expressions used. "There can be no disparity in marriage like unsuitability of mind and purpose. The first mistaken impulse of an undisciplined heart. My love was founded on a rock." But we were at home, and the trodden leaves were lying underfoot, and the autumn wind was blowing. Chapter 46. Intelligence. I must have been married, if I may trust to my imperfect memory for dates, about a year or so, when one evening, as I was returning from a solitary walk, thinking of the book I was then writing, for my success had steadily increased with my steady application, and I was engaged at that time upon my first work of fiction, I came past Mrs. Steerforth's house. I'd often passed it before, during my residence in that neighbourhood, though never when I could choose another road. Howbeit, it did sometimes happen that it wasn't easy to find another without making a long circuit, and so I had passed that way upon the whole pretty often. I'd never done more than glance at the house as I went by with a quickened step. It had been uniformly gloomy and dull. None of the best rooms abutted on the road, and the narrow, heavily framed old-fashioned windows, never cheerful under any circumstances, looked very dismal, close shut, and with their blinds always drawn down. There was a covered way across a little paved court to an entrance that was never used, and there was one round staircase window at odds with all the rest, and the only one unshaded by a blind, which had the same unoccupied blank look. I don't remember that I ever saw a light in all the house. If I'd been a casual passer-by, I should have probably supposed that some childless person lay dead in it. If I had happily possessed no knowledge of the place, and had seen it often in that changeless state, I should have pleased my fancy with many ingenious speculations, I dare say. As it was, I thought as little of it as I might. But my mind couldn't go by it and leave it as my body did. And it usually awakened a long train of meditations. Coming before me on this particular evening that I mentioned, mingled with the childish recollections and later fancies, the ghosts of half-formed hopes, the broken shadows of disappointments dimly seen and understood, the blending of experience and imagination incidental to the occupation with which my thoughts had been busy, it was more than commonly suggestive. I fell into a brown study as I walked on, and a voice at my side made me start. It was a woman's voice, too. I was not long in recollecting Mrs. Steerforth's little parlour-maid, who had formerly worn blue ribbons in her cap. She'd taken them out now to adapt herself, I suppose, to the altered character of the house, and wore but one or two disconsolate bows of sober brown. "If you please, sir, would you have the goodness to walk in and speak to Miss Dartle?" "Has Miss Dartle sent you for me?" I inquired. "Not tonight, sir, but it's just the same. Miss Dartle saw you pass a night or two ago, and I was to sit at work on the staircase, and when I saw you pass again, to ask you to step in and speak to her." I turned back and inquired of my conductor, as we went along, how Mrs. Steerforth was. She said her lady was but poorly, and kept her own room a good deal. When we arrived at the house, I was directed to Miss Dartle in the garden, and left to make my presence known to her myself. She was sitting on a seat at one end of a kind of terrace overlooking the great city. It was a sombre evening, with a lurid light in the sky, and as I saw the prospect scowling in the distance, with here and there some larger objects starting up into the sullen glare, I fancied it was no inapt companion to the memory of this fierce woman. She saw me as I advanced, and rose for a moment to receive me. I thought her then still more colourless and thin than when I had seen her last, the flashing eyes still brighter, and the scar still plainer. Our meeting was not cordial. We had parted angrily on the last occasion, and there was an air of disdain about her which she took no pains to conceal. "I'm told you wish to speak to me, Miss Dartle," said I, standing near her with my hand upon the back of the seat and declining her gesture of invitation to sit down. "If you please," said she. "Pray, has this girl been found?" "No." "And yet she's run away." I saw her thin lips working while she looked at me, as if they were eager to load her with reproaches. "Run away?" I repeated. "Yes." "From him," she said with a laugh. "If she's not found, perhaps she never will be found. She may be dead." The vaunting cruelty with which she met my glance I never saw expressed in any other face that ever I have seen. "To wish her dead," said I, "may be the kindest wish that one of her own sex could bestow upon her. I'm glad that time has softened you so much, Miss Dartle." She condescended to make no reply, but turning on me with another scornful laugh, said, "The friends of this excellent and much-injured young lady are friends of yours. You are their champion and assert their rights. Do you wish to know what is known of her?" "Yes," said I. She rose with an ill-favoured smile, and taking a few steps towards a wall of holly that was near at hand, dividing the lawn from the kitchen garden, said in a louder voice, "Come here," as if she were calling to some unclean beast. "You will restrain any demonstrative championship or vengeance in this place, of course, Mr. Copfield," said she, looking over her shoulder at me with the same expression. I inclined my head without knowing what she meant, and she said, "Come here," again, and returned, followed by the respectable Mr. Littimer, who, with undiminished respectability, made me a bow, and took up his position behind her. the air of wicked grace, of triumph, in which, strange to say, there was yet something feminine and alluring, with which she reclined upon the seat between us and looked at me, was worthy of a cruel princess in a legend. "Now," she said imperiously, without glancing at him and touching the